Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Tuesday, November the 20th. My name's John Dennis and you're listening to News Desk. Today, pressure grows on the government to give up trying to find a buyer for Northern Rock. The Lib Dems' Vincent Cable talks to us.
One of the vulnerabilities of this model of growth that the government has presided over is that it does leave the economy very vulnerable to a financial shock.
Also today, the prospect of a fresh conflict in the Balkans as Kosovo Albanians push for independence. And France is paralysed by strikes. The government's considering a management buyout of Northern Rock. Vince Cable is the Liberal Democrats' Treasury spokesman and also the party's acting leader. He says that with the value of the bank still plummeting, finding anyone to buy it looks unlikely.
Well, the prospects currently look rather poor. I mean, it would be an ideal solution if the government could help find a buyer who was willing to operate it as a going concern, keep the brand, keep the Northeast network, repay the government. That would be an ideal solution. But judging by the quality of the bids yesterday, that now seems rather remote. And any private bid is likely, I think, now to be some venture capital operator who will simply take the bank apart, take their pickings, and probably inflict considerable losses on the taxpayer.
And another option, which not many people are really in favour of, is forcing the bank into administration.
Well, that's the nuclear option, and that's one way of turning off the tap of public money by simply bringing the agony to an end. And that may well happen. I mean, even if nobody wants it, it may well happen if a buyer can't be found on suitable terms. The danger, of course, with that is, of course, not just that the shareholders lose all their money. The government would probably lose quite a lot of money as the assets were sold off in disadvantageous conditions. The Northeast operation would be wiped out with all the jobs. It would be a pretty drastic solution.
But you've been arguing for nationalising the bank. What would be the advantage of that?
Well, I'm not advancing this with any enthusiasm, and I'm not advancing it as a clause for socialists, anything but. I mean, it's simply as a pragmatic option of keeping the bank afloat, but where you're eliminating the conflict of interest between the shareholders and the taxpayers by making the taxpayer the owner, which is what public ownership would mean. The government's already nationalised the liabilities of the bank. I'm just suggesting it should take over the assets of the bank temporarily to stabilise the situation and prepare for a sale in more satisfactory conditions. Or it may not even be a sale. It could revert the bank to mutual ownership, which is works very satisfactorily for banks like Nationwide, and as was how Northern Rock used to be in the happier days before the conversion.
Would nationalising the bank preserve confidence in the banking system?
Well, the confidence in the banking system is at a very low ebb anyway. I don't know how it would play out in the markets, but that's, I don't think, any longer the issue. The reason why there's been a collapse in confidence in the banking system are for much wider reasons.
Do you think it's still possible at this stage for Alistair Darling and Labour to preserve their reputation for economic competence?
Well, I would hope in all our interests that they do so, and I don't wish to over-dramatise this. Certainly for 10 years the Labour government has had a reasonably good record in economic stability and growth, and a lot of this went down to the creation of the independence of the Bank of England, and something we supported, indeed advocated, and that's worked generally pretty well. The link between overall economic management and this specific banking crisis is the following, that what has kept the economy going over the last 2 to 3 years particularly is this boom in credit and the massive build-up of personal debt in Britain, much of it secured against the housing market. And one of the vulnerabilities of this model of growth that the government has presided over is that it does leave the economy very vulnerable to a financial shock.
Finally, Mr. Cable, I'd like to ask you a question on a different subject, if you don't mind. Chris Huhne described his rival in the Lib Dem leadership race as Calamity Clegg. Do you think these sorts of personal attacks are helpful to the party?
Well, I didn't see this exchange on television, or I'd rather just saw the edited bits of it. Chris Huhne denied that he had called ethnic calamity and but acknowledged but accepted responsibility for what his team had been doing and has apologised for it. And I would hope that those apologies effectively close down this exchange. I mean, I simply would say, as somebody who's not directly involved in it, that both of them were criticised for being boring when they weren't exchanging punches, and now they are. They're being attacked for from the opposite sense. I mean, I think this is inevitable in any closely contested leadership race, so I don't lose too much sleep over it.
Who will you be supporting?
I'm not supporting either candidate, and it would be highly inappropriate, given that I'm the acting leader.
Vince Cable, many thanks for talking to us. Now, Matt Weaver joins us with the papers. Matt, Alistair Darling, the Chancellor, gave a statement on Northern Rock to the Commons yesterday. What do the papers make of that?
Yeah, well, the papers make very grim reading for Alistair Darling this morning. Cartoonists, sketch writers and columnists all pile into him. Shares in Alistair Darling plunged yesterday as investors queued round the Treasury to withdraw their deposits, says the Telegraph's Andrew Jimson. Anne Treneman in The Times likens Darling to a hapless commuter stuck on a train with the wrong sort of loans on the line. He may be Chancellor, but he has no control, she says. Simon Carr in The Independent predicts that if Darling can organise a takeover, the new owners will screw the government because, as he says, Darling has to sell and no one has to buy. The Times' cartoonist Peter Brooks depicts Darling doubling up in agony after being kicked between the legs by a steel toe-capped Northern Rock boot. And not to be outgrossed, Steve Bell in The Guardian shows Darling trying to sell buckets of cold sick.
Now, church leaders are getting worried about what The Telegraph says is a government attack on fatherhood.
Yeah, this is proposals in the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Bill. The church leaders say that the bill will make it easier for lesbian couples to become parents by removing the requirement on fertility clinics to consider the need for a father before providing IVF treatment. Yesterday, the leader of the Roman Catholic Church in England, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, said the bill would radically undermine the place of the father in children's lives. And today, the Anglican Archbishop of York, John Sentamu, said much the same thing. But Tom Sutcliffe in The Independent says that church leaders are engaging in an unfair attack on lesbians. He says they make far better fathers than many men and that heterosexual couples have a far from unblemished record of supplying children with a stable Janet and John model of parenthood, as the church leaders seem to want.
Now, state of emergency in Pakistan, as we know, one of the opposition leaders who have been imprisoned is Imran Khan, the former cricketer.
Yeah, Imran Khan has started a hunger strike at protests at the imposition of emergency rule by General Musharraf. And as he's an international celebrity, the crisis in Pakistan gets more coverage than usual today. But the Mail seems to be more concerned with Khan's physique. It quotes his former wife Jemima Khan saying that he could get very thin.
Perceptive remark.
More significantly, the Financial Times reports that General Musharraf has flown to Saudi Arabia amid speculation that he is to meet the exiled former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. A diplomat tells the paper that Musharraf could be trying to head off a proposed alliance between Sharif and Benazir Bhutto. And today, Pakistan's government has said that the elections will be held on January the 8th and that 3,000 people arrested under emergency rule will be released. It's unclear if Imran Khan is going to be one of them.
On Wednesday, Matt, big match, England v Croatia. Gordon Brown's not going to be there.
No. The Sun says that every time Gordon Brown turns up to an international rugby or football match involving British teams, those teams lose. So it's been running this a wonderfully spurious campaign to persuade Gordon Brown not to watch England's crucial game against Croatia tomorrow. And now Brown's office has confirmed that he won't be going to Wembley. It quotes an official spokesman saying, some have argued he's not been the best of omens so far. The Sun's headline says, Brown's jinxed and he knows he is.
Why is there going to be a pub crawl in honour of the Bishop of Southwark?
Well, you may remember this very curious and infamous story last year. The Bishop of Southwark, Tom Butler, allegedly had a sort of drunken rambling after a reception at the Irish embassy. The Times claims that a charity pub crawl is to be held to mark the first anniversary of the meanderings of the bishop. It points out that Butler has always denied that he was drunk on the night in question, but it reminds us that he ended up with a black eye amid reports that he'd been seen throwing toys out of Mercedes and uttering the words, I'm the Bishop of Southwark, it's what I do. The pub crawl is being organised by the satirical Christian website Ship of Fools to raise money for a Sudan children's charity, the Times says. It prints an itinerary for the evening plus a map and says some of those taking part will be wearing fancy fancy dress modelled on characters in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
Well, cheers, Matt. Your good health. And don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap, our daily email service. Review the papers every day, guardian.co.uk/wrap. Also on Guardian Unlimited today, Pakistan's government says it's freed 3,000 prisoners held under emergency rule. Latest on that at guardian.co.uk/Pakistan. England's goalkeeper Paul Robinson made errors in a training session and now his position's in doubt for tomorrow's Euro 2008 qualifying match against Croatia. Guardian.co.uk/football is the place to go for all the build-up to that crucial game. And British television won 7 International Emmy Awards. Among the winners was the BBC talent show How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria, which sounded a bit like this.
Don't stop me, 'cause I'm having a good time.
Full coverage of the Emmys at mediaguardian.co.uk. The United States and the European Union are trying to head off a threat by Kosovo to break away from Serbia. Kosovo's been under UN and NATO protection since 1999, when troops were sent in to avoid genocide led by the then Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic. Ian Traynor is our Europe editor and he's in Brussels. He says the issue of independence has come to a head now because there's a deadline of December the 10th, when, after 2 years of fruitless negotiations, Kosovo's new leader, Hashim Thaci, will unilaterally declare independence.
Kosovo has been in this limbo. It formally belongs to Serbia, but the Serbs have no say in the running of it, and it's been like that since the end of the war in 1999. So it's been under, a UN protectorate under UN governance. Can't go on like that forever, basically. Its status has to be sorted out. Nothing can actually happen in Kosovo until we know what it is. Is it a country? Is it not a country? Will it be independent? No money will go in, no investment. It can't join international organizations, and so on and so forth. And this limbo is basically ineffectual, and it's widely regarded that it should not be allowed to persist forever. Besides, it risks a backlash by a very disaffected Albanian majority there who just get fed up and go on the warpath.
There's a lot at stake here, isn't there?
There's a lot at stake in various ways for lots of people. First of all, it ultimately concerns the people that live there, namely the Albanians and the Serbs who lay claim to it, because if you go back centuries, of course, it has been historically a part of Serbia. That's the first thing on the ground. Internationally, it's a European Union project. It is part of Europe. The EU regards itself. It doesn't want another war in its backyard. It wants to accept responsibility. It's using Kosovo as an exercise in its so-called common foreign policy making, and it would be responsible for steering Kosovo to statehood. So it's a big test for European credibility. That is indeed being tested and challenged by Russia primarily, which supports Serbia. So as part of this new standoff between Russia and the West on a whole range of issues, Kosovo is one of the big ones. So also from the European point of view, if Putin and the Kremlin gets away by challenging European policymaking, dividing Europe against itself and winning that diplomatic contest, Europe will look feeble in the extreme. It will look as though it's kowtowing to Moscow, that it's caved before the Kremlin, and it will not augur well for European policymaking. And then, of course, you've got the Americans as well, and they support Kosovo independence.
The US and the Europeans are attempting to avert the breakaway. How might they be able to do it?
Well, you've had 2 years, effectively, 2 years of negotiations, sometimes proxy negotiations, sometimes direct, between the Serbs and the Albanians, all under international mediation. That process is now moving to a climax. The deadline is December the 10th, when the so-called troika of EU, American and Russian envoys are to report to the UN Security Council on the result of those negotiations. Now, it's absolute dead cert that it's stalemate. So what happens next? The Europeans who are in the driving seat are basically pushing for a form of recognition. Now, the headlines this morning and much of the international press are suggesting that the Europeans are getting cold feet about independence for Kosovo. In fact, it's probably the other way around. They're basically trying to control declaration of independence by Kosovo, delay it slightly, but only by a matter of weeks, and in return for that, recognise it en masse, 27 EU countries plus the Americans, very, very quickly. What they're frightened of is a vacuum opening up between a Kosovo unilateral declaration of independence, and then a pause and a vacuum between when it goes unrecognised, and that vacuum will be filled by frustration and violence.
I'm Alok Jha, and on this week's Science Weekly, we discuss science on the top of Mount Everest with special guest Dr. Hugh Montgomery, genetics researcher, intensive care doctor, and mountaineer. Also in the show, we hear from science writer Phil Ball about the human herd mentality in the physical laws of society, plus cloned monkeys, another climate change report, and a new species of dinosaur. That's all on Science Weekly, guardian.co.uk/science.
A wave of industrial unrest is paralysing France. Teachers, postal workers and other civil servants are joining transport workers to challenge President Nicolas Sarkozy's plans to reform the economy. Angélique Chrysaphis is our correspondent in Paris. She says they're all ostensibly on strike for different reasons.
These are the people that are walking off stopping work today. Teachers, tax inspectors, weather forecasters, air traffic controllers, bus drivers, train drivers, postal workers, students, gas, electricity, even the makers of Yoplait yoghurt, French bank workers, and there are no papers because the newspaper distributors have gone on strike.
And even the tobacconists are going on strike against anti-smoking laws.
That's tomorrow, but don't forget the magistrates and local judges will be going on strike next week.
Why are they all taking industrial action at the same time?
It's very interesting. We're now on our seventh day of the rail and bus strikes. These started over the issue of pensions, which is a big metaphor in France. It's always been a very sensitive issue. Basically, some state workers, for example, railway drivers, can retire early, some as young as 50, on special deals. Nicolas Sarkozy wants to reform that, and that's why the transport workers are on strike. But today's strike by civil servants is completely unrelated. It should only last for 24 hours, but all these strike movements are now converging in one black week for Nicolas Sarkozy.
To what extent has Nicolas Sarkozy sought confrontation in the same way that Margaret Thatcher took on the unions in the UK in the 1980s?
Well, there's been a lot of debate here about whether or not this is Nicolas Sarkozy's Thatcher moment, and I think the answer to that is no, and everyone is very much in agreement. First of all, the situations are very different. Thatcher was at a very different stage in her career. Nicolas Sarkozy has just been elected with a huge mandate for change. But he's also not being hugely forceful and belligerent this week. Some people can say that he knew that people were going to come onto the streets because he wants to modernise France. But if you look at the way he's acting in recent days, he's more like Father Christmas. He's very keen to hand people sweets, little sweeteners, little presents to make them accept his reforms. The transport workers will start negotiating tomorrow and we'll see what happens there. But the civil servants want better salaries and less job cuts. And there's a sense that he might make a speech in the next few days easing the difficulties of cost of living.
There won't be anyone in France unaffected by this industrial action. How is it affecting Nicolas Sarkozy's popularity?
Well, it's quite interesting. I think you have to look at what people's lives are like in France for the last few weeks. People are getting up at 4 a.m, some people having to sleep in their offices, people having to walk for about 3 hours, hitchhike, hire motorcycle taxis to get around. It's quite traumatic, especially for people who run shops and boutiques who've seen their business nosedive to levels that hasn't been seen since May 68. Now, Sarkozy is still popular. He's still got good poll ratings, but they are dropping. The main issue that's come out today is that French people can't afford the cost of living. They've got very low salaries. They can barely afford to pay their rents, let alone any perks like holidays. Now, he knows that he has to address this issue if the public isn't going to start backing these civil servants who are on strike today.
Angélique Chrysaphis. I'm John Dennis, and you're listening to News Desk. Still to come, we hear from Britain's champion jockey, Seb Sanders, and from the UK's oldest newlyweds.
How long before you proposed to her?
3 weeks, I think.
That's quite quick.
Well, you've got to be a dowry.
But first, Gordon Brown made his first big speech on the environment yesterday. The Prime Minister called for a technological revolution to resist global warming. He set tough targets for reducing carbon and warned of hard choices ahead. The Guardian's environment editor John Vidal says Brown made some new pledges on tackling climate change, but also some recycled ones.
just before he stood up and got it, we had a phone call saying that he was actually going to give a commitment of 40% renewable electricity within 20 years. Now, this would have been quite astonishing. I mean, someone's described it like an Apollo moonshot or something. It wasn't like that. It wasn't quite as ambitious. He aimed high, but there wasn't that much new. There were some very eye-catching things, though.
Could you give us some idea of what he said?
Well, it's going to be a lot of energy saving. Very dull. It seems very dull stuff. Energy saving for households. Big new programs for insulation. 5 million people going to get new insulation. Lots of stuff for gadgetry and whatever. On the sort of low income level, a lot of people are going to benefit over the next 5 or 6 years for this. Apart from that, he seems to be determined to be rid of the plastic bag, the one-use plastic bag. The idea of the disposable plastic bag is an environmental symbol of waste, he said. He said he saw no reason why we shouldn't get rid of it. Eliminate it completely.
And he signalled that he might be prepared to set a more ambitious target to cut Britain's carbon emissions.
Nothing new on that. He did actually say that in the Energy White Paper a few months ago. So I personally don't think that would happen because the ministry hasn't even costed it out. He's holding it out. That's what all the NGO groups want. They want this absolute commitment of 80%. The real problem is, what is he actually going to do? Where is his commitments now? What is his new policies? And there, we didn't actually see that much.
You've said before on the podcast, John, that you didn't think that Gordon Brown really got climate change. Do you think there are signs in this speech that it's beginning to dawn on him the scale of the challenge ahead?
I think there is. There were two very significant things in there. One was the tone. The tone was much more serious. I mean, he's, in the past, he's kind of dismissed it. He's sort of spread it out. There was a genuine sense that he realises what this actually means for Britain. I mean, he's talking about a technological revolution. And something on a great scale. Now, she's never talked about that before. It means an industrial revolution. Now, for Brown to say this is very, very significant. And also the other interesting thing is John Hutton, the energy secretary, who is going to be in charge of all this, wasn't actually there. But Hilary Benn, the environment secretary, was. So it does seem that the environment side of things is getting a definite boost, and the industry people are, who should be always against renewables, or pretty well, are slightly on the back foot now.
And what's been the response to his speech?
Lots of welcoming noises for the genuinely new, and lots of disappointment, as ever. The Greenpeaces, the Friends of the Earth and whatever are saying that he should have gone further and committed himself and let's see some real policies and all that. The industry, I think the supermarkets are a little bit worried about the plastic bags. The plastics industry certainly is. And someone made a very good point that no industry is going to change its investment, is going to really invest in renewables unless it can actually see the real policies which are going to come out of it. And at the moment, we can't see that. So industry is not absolutely sure which way it is going to go. Does he really mean it? Or is this actually the first sign that things are changing?
John Vidal. Now racing, and in one of the most exciting climaxes to the flat racing season ever witnessed, Seb Sanders finished as joint champion jockey along with the previous winner Jamie Spencer. Sanders had been written off as a mere journeyman, and The Guardian's Donald McRae asked him whether that tag was hurtful.
It's probably the thing that probably irks me the most is being called a journeyman jockey. The thing is with me, why I'm, you know, have to work so hard is, for me to find a good one, I've got to sit on probably 1,000 horses, and you know, to find a good one. And then when I find it, I've got to chain myself to it. And it's not always easy to do that when I'm retained by Sir Mark. But I mean, fortunate enough, you know, Sir Mark has good horses as well, and I don't have to chain myself to them. They're mine anyway. But you know, it's I'm not riding for a Sir Michael Stout, and I'm not riding for Cornwall, and I'm not riding for Godolphin. So I have to go and find these horses. And I'm a journeyman, yes, but I'm only a journeyman because I want to get on the best. And it's very, very difficult to find the good ones.
And that's why this championship, I mean, must put to bed that tag once and for all. And you must feel just enormous. Even though you've had such belief, you must have such vindication that no one can ever say, oh, Seb's a journeyman, you're a champion jockey.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. That sounds great.
Seb Sanders talking to Donald McRae, and you can hear a longer version of that interview and read all about it at guardian.co.uk/sport.
On this week's Football Weekly, after the miracle in the Holy Land, will England be on top of the world and looking down on Croatia? There's Scotland's heartbreak at Hampden Park, and we ask Juan Román Riquelme, why is he unstoppable in an international jersey and unemployable in a club one? That's Football Weekly. For more information, go to guardian.co.uk/podcast.
James Mason tied the knot with his bride Peggy yesterday. James is 93, Peggy's 84, and that makes them Britain's oldest newlyweds. The Guardian's Stephen Morris reports from Paignton.
A boy band's teeny bopper hit may not be the obvious choice of music for a couple with the combined age of 177 years as they arrive at their wedding ceremony. But Boyzone's No Matter What is Peggy's favourite tune. And if you take the leap of faith to get married at the age of 84 to a man of 93 years, then you're probably entitled to play exactly what you want. Mr. Mason, congratulations on today. How do you feel?
Very, very happy.
Tell me about your bride.
Well, I think she's lovely. I was at the day centre having lunch, and I looked up and I saw her, and something told me, that's it. And I went for it. And I beat off all the oncomers, and I got her.
What did you say to her?
No, I think she said to me, do you come here often? And I said, yes, every day. And then I took her to come and sit by me. After that, after we had lunch, I said, well, come on, let me take you out for a little drive. And so we drove to Berry Head, looked over the sea. And
you knew straight away this was the woman for you?
Oh, absolutely. There was no two ways about it. As I looked into her eyes, that was it.
How long before you proposed to her?
3 weeks, I think.
That's quite quick.
Well, you've got to be at our age.
So are you nervous now?
No. I'm just looking forward to it.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Alderway Mansion on this very special occasion. And it's your birthday, Penny.
Yes.
In front of friends, family, and the great and good of Torbay, not to mention a battery of cameras and microphones, Peggy married James Mason yesterday. They became Britain's oldest newlyweds, proving it's never too late to find love.
I do solemnly declare that I know not of any lawful impediment
while I, David Harold James Mason,
ladies and gentlemen, Peggy and James have shown us today that if you have an open heart, love can find you whatever time of life you're in. It is my great pleasure to announce that you're now...
Then it's off for the wedding snaps. There's not just one official photographer here. It's more like a celebrity wedding with snappers jostling for the best shots and urging the beaming couple to share one more kiss and another and another.
Just one more kiss. One more kiss, guys. One more kiss.
What's one more kiss?
Mrs. Mason, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful. I've just realised he's my husband. He makes me happy. He makes me so happy because we're laughing all the time. We find funny things in everything, don't we? And that's great at our time of life to laugh.
Steve Morris reporting. And congratulations, I think, to James Mason and his bride, Peggy. News Desk was produced today by Phil Maynard, Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.